Well, good evening. We are ready to get to the heart of our discussions on church leadership. The last two classes have been significant, but by and large mostly introductory, talking about God's plan for leadership throughout the ages and then the process of training, selecting, and appointing leaders in the church. Now we're going to spend the next several weeks looking specifically at the qualifications of elders. And we get our list. The rest of the class is going to be primarily drawn from two passages. There is a third that oftentimes gets included, and so I think it's probably best as we begin this process of looking at the qualifications of elders that we read these three passages, just to kind of get a good overview of the things that we're going to talk about. So there's three of them. I wrote them up on the board for you. 1 Timothy chapter 3, verses 1 through 7. Then again, Titus chapter 1, verses 5 through 9. Those are by far the two passages that we'll spend the most time in. There are some things that we could either look at as duties, or sometimes we could consider them qualifications. It just depends on your perspective on it. From 1 Peter, the 5th chapter, verses 1 through 4. So let's start by reading those. And if someone would, let's start in 1 Timothy chapter 3, if you'd read the first 7 verses there.
This is a faithful saying: if a man desires the position of a bishop, he desires a good work. A bishop then must be blameless, the husband of one wife, temperate, sober-minded, of good behavior, hospitable, able to teach. Not given to wine, not violent, not greedy for money, but gentle, not quarrelsome, not covetous. One who rules his own house well, having his children in submission with all reverence. For if a man does not know how to rule his own house, how will he take care of the church of God? Not a novice, lest being puffed up with pride, he fall into the same condemnation as the devil. Moreover, he must have a good testimony among those who are outside, lest he fall into reproach and the snare of the devil.
Okay. Let's look at Titus chapter 1. Would someone read the verses 5 through 9?
For this reason, I like you to decree that you should set in order the things that are lacking and appoint elders in every city as I commanded you. The man is blameless, the husband of one wife, having faithful children, not accused of dissipation or ordination. For a bishop must be blameless as a steward of God, not self-willed, not quick-tempered, not given to wine, not violent, not greedy for money, but hospitable, a lover of what is good, sober-minded, just, holy, self-controlled, holding fast the faithful word as he has been taught, that he may be able by sound doctrine both to exhort and to convict those who contradict.
All right. And then let's finish up by looking at 1 Peter 5, and if someone would read the first 4 verses there.
The elders who are among you, I exhort, who is a fellow elder and a witness of the suffering of Christ, and also to the taker of the glory that will be revealed. Shepherd the flock of God which is among you, serving as an overseer, not by compulsion, but willingly, not for dishonest gain, but eager, not as being lords over those entrusted to you, but examples of the flock. And when the chief shepherd appears, you will receive the crown of glory that does not fade away.
All right. I think we're going to spend most of our time over the next several weeks looking at those three passages. The elders here have broken down the discussion into groups of qualifications as opposed to looking at each one separately and sort of going through the list. They're categorized. The three that we're going to address today are blameless, of good behavior, and having a good testimony, specifically a good testimony from those who are without. So those are the three that we're going to attempt to address, but I actually think there's a couple of interesting things that we need to talk about since this is the first of the classes on the qualifications. I think there's a couple of things that we should address before we get into those three issues. The first thing is, I think it's interesting when we look at Titus, the first chapter there, that the fifth verse, it appears as though Titus is given some instructions on a couple of things. We see that this is we would look to this and say this is probably where we can see some of the work of an evangelist, that he's instructed to do two things. One is to set in order those things that are lacking, which is a very broad statement, and then a very specific statement, that being appoint elders in every city as I've commanded you. I think Bob touched on this a little bit when he talked about God's plan for leadership, but with the church, I think it's important that we point out that the ideal arrangement is that every city, every congregation, have its own elders, and that they be its own elders, that we never see an example in the Bible of elders ruling over multiple congregations. That was, in fact, what we saw at the beginning of the apostate church, or at least part of it, where this division between overseers and presbyters and elders and bishops, that somehow those are different. And they're not. They're all the same. But yet here, one of the things that's lacking appears to be elders in every city. So sort of it goes both ways. One is that in an ideal arrangement, a congregation has elders, and those elders rule over that congregation and that congregation alone. Another thing that I think is important as we get into these qualifications is to ask this question, and I'm looking for a response on this. Are these lists of traits, are these qualifications, are they requirements? Are they recommendations? Are they just suggestions? What are these?
When you use the word must, that gets pretty definite, doesn't it?
Absolutely. And I think it's important. That's the very first thing. Note the consistent use of the word must. These qualifications are, in fact, requirements. Okay, it's not an option. It's not a, well, it would be good if elders had these qualifications. No, they must have these qualifications. If a man doesn't meet one of the qualifications, then he is entirely disqualified. There are some of these qualifications, as we look at them, that are subjective. We're going to talk about three that are relatively subjective. Blameless, good behavior, of good testimony. There may be some discussion about what exactly it means to be blameless. You and I may have some different definitions of what it means to be blameless. Others of these qualifications, they're not subjective at all. They're very definitive. First and foremost, we know that, a good example, I guess you should say it that way, a good example is that an elder must be the husband of one wife. Well, that in turn means that elders must be men. Now, we can see in the religious community around us that that particular qualification sort of gets ignored. That it's, well, there was a different time, or for whatever reason. Our society seems to be okay with this idea of allowing unqualified individuals to do certain tasks, particularly if it means that we benefit from it. And really a good example of that is, look at the amount of illegal immigrants that are hired. It's illegal. That's why it's called illegal immigrants. But yet, they're not qualified to work in the United States, yet we allow them to work. And we see those sorts of things happen in the church, too. That we have sort of it's just an interesting movement towards allowing people who the scriptures show are unqualified to participate in works that they're not qualified to do. Let me give you an example. One example is that we see some congregations now, even amongst groups that bear the name Church of Christ, have women elders. Which, again, this is not a subjective thing. That we may disagree on what it means to be blameless, but there's very little dispute about whether a person is a man or a woman. It's not a disputable thing. When I was looking up these qualifications of blameless specifically, I found that there was a movement within some of the larger churches of Christ, particularly those preachers and our institutional systems, that they actually separate these passages. They separate 1 Timothy from Titus and make it as if they're talking about two different groups of people. Both elders, but two types of elders. They look at the instructions to Titus and say that these apply to all elders, regardless of what subtype of elder And then they look at the instructions to Timothy and say that these are apply to teaching elders. But there are, in fact, two different types of elders. There are teaching elders and ruling elders. This is a distinction that the Bible makes. It's a distinction that people have made. And you think about, well, what's the point of that? Well, yes, Timothy is told that they must be apt to teach, and Titus is not. There's other qualifications that work that same way. But the distinction is being made to allow people who are unqualified to serve in the office of elder. If you're not apt to teach, if you're part of a larger institution where teaching is not, that opportunity doesn't exist, or you're just not trained in that process, then you develop this system where it's possible that people are fully qualified in every other way, but just not apt to teach, and then, well, that's not really fair that those people aren't qualified to be elders. It's not the way the system works. The way the Lord established this is that these are requirements. If you don't meet a qualification, then you're entirely disqualified. So let's ask the question the other direction. If a man meets all of the qualifications, does this mean that he must become an elder? No, absolutely not. I think it's Mike that's going to later talk about desire. It appears as though one of the first qualifications is that you need to desire the position. And I'll let Mike address that. But if a person doesn't desire the position, then maybe that's a qualification, maybe it's not. But if they're not, they don't want to be an elder, then we can't make them be an elder. That's what Peter says. But there may be other reasons not mentioned here why an individual would be prevented from serving as an elder. I don't know that I want to give an example, but I think you can imagine in your mind somebody's fully qualified, but yet there's just something that doesn't add up quite right. Tad?
Well, one kind of benign example is sometimes it's just not a need. You know, like for example, in Acts chapter 5 or 6, I don't know, one of the two chapters when the first deacons are appointed, I'm sure there were lots of men qualified. I mean, there were thousands of people there in Jerusalem, and the apostles picked seven. We need seven people. And that's what they needed. They didn't need 12 or 13. They didn't need all the other people that were qualified.
That's a good point. That's a good point.
All right, I want to get into a part of our discussion. Let's look first at blameless. Both
1 Timothy and Titus mentioned that an elder needs to be blameless.
And I think it's interesting that Paul mentions it twice in Titus, and it's the first qualification mentioned by Paul in both passages. I think it probably tells us two things.
One is, I think it tells us the importance of blamelessness,
that it is extremely important that an elder be blameless. But also, it may be that this is an overarching generic qualification, a general principle, a general qualification that all the other specifics fall under. Now, I think if we look at the other specifics, we could say, well, yes, that qualification can be described as a trait of being blameless. So I think that all other qualifications fall under this big umbrella of an elder being blameless. But blameless is mentioned in and of itself. So what does it mean to be blameless? Well, let's ask just a simple question. Does it mean that they're sinless? No, certainly not. We know from Romans
chapter 3, verse 23, all have sinned and fallen short of the glory of God.
We know the names of a few elders in the New Testament.
Who can you think of
that we know for sure were elders? James. Okay. Who else?
Peter.
I think Gaius is another one that we know. But think about Peter. Just because we know more about him than we know the others. Was Peter sinless?
What?
No. Peter denied the Lord. Peter split the church by Jews and Gentiles. He was accused by Paul. I mean, so it doesn't mean sinless. So it's got to mean something else. Well, does it mean that the person can't be accused? Is that they're beyond accusation? Is that what being blameless means? No, can't say that either, right? Because remember, Jesus was blameless, but Jesus was accused of all kinds of things. So it's not about not being a sinner. It's not about being above accusations. It's more about that the accusations just don't stick. That there's no merit to the accusations. Literally, it means without blame, irreproachable. That might be another word that we don't often use, but that's the description here. It's not specific to any one part of the elder's life, but all of his life. Blameless in conduct, blameless in speech, blameless in doctrine. And when we look at all of the other qualifications, they seem to describe that. That it's all of his life is blameless. Blameless inside of the church and blameless outside of the church. In many ways, it's about reputation. And I think it's good that blameless gets tied tonight with this idea of having a good testimony, because they, in a lot of ways, go hand in hand. So let me ask this. Why must an elder be blameless?
Any time that you're put in a position of leadership, you have lots of eyes looking at you. You have people that are following your example. So if you're not blameless, you could be teaching bad things.
All right.
So like, well, our elder does it, why can't I do it?
Okay, so I think there's two issues buried in that. One is to be, if you're blameless, it makes you a more effective leader. If you have blame, sort of undermines your ability to lead people. What else, Mike?
Well, I just wanted to say something about what that same subject and what Bob said there was, we also have to distinguish, you know, he said, if my elder does it, then why can't I? There's also a difference in practicing something and something in the past that that elder, whether he was an elder then or not, may have done in the past, but not be, he can't be blamed for it now. See what I'm saying? And so the question I'm getting at is, it would be great if all elders or evangelists and deacons could never be, you know, you could never say that they ever had blame against them, but we know that's not possible for any human being. So the question, you know, I'm getting at is, you know, is there a distinction between practicing something, or is it something that they may have done in the past, been forgiven of, and then there's a burden that falls on the followers, the congregation, to forget that, realize that elder is a human being also, and not hold him blame, not hold blame against him for something.
Yeah, I think Peter is a perfect example. And
obviously,
of that.
If he's practicing something,
yeah,
that's not going to fly.
Yeah. Well, yeah. Is it? I mean, all of us at one time in our life were reproachable, weren't we?
Right.
We all have sinned, which brings reproach on us. So there is a time when, look at Peter. You know, there was a time when he was called out by Jesus and called out by Paul. He was not blameless at that time. But you know, those are historical things. Surely.
I think Paul was being an example to look to.
Oh, yeah.
Because even in the second Jerusalem,
yeah.
That's a good,
there are some things that in your past will disqualify you. And I think that as we start talking about some of the other qualifications, I think specifically of husband of one wife, that you know, there may have been things that happened in the past that now disqualify you. I guess we'll cross that bridge when whoever has that assignment speaks on that. But
probably the category of not being a novice is where this kicks in. See, what Mike was saying, when you start out as a young person, like look at Peter, and as he gains some experience and knowledge, hopefully, you know, as you gain experience and knowledge, your mistakes.
Yeah, you become a little more well established.
Yeah,
a little less movable in those. That's a good point. All right, so the first thing is, you need to be blameless. An elder needs to be blameless because if not, it undermines their effectiveness as a leader. But I think sort of related to that, it undermines your his ability to appropriately apply discipline in the church too. And it's sort of that, well, the elders do it, why can't I? Or it may not be that specific thing, but it may be something else. And so whether that's right or wrong, we know people do that. And it's not that you can't have a history of doing things that were sinful and apply discipline, but certainly you must be blameless in order to apply that. What may be one other reason that an elder must be blameless?
They had to go deal with purity.
Purity of what?
There's certainly purity of doctrine. There's purity of life, behaviors. You got something else in mind?
Yeah, right. I'm thinking of the purity of the church. In a lot of ways, the elder, whether it's right or wrong, becomes, you know, they are the leader of the congregation. They may become the face of the congregation or faces of the congregation to the community in many aspects. And if you're blameable, then you may bring reproach upon the church. Dwayne, you've been itching, I can tell.
Yeah, well, I just had about reproach. I think we look in the 10th verse when it talks of the same word about deacons. It says, let them be tested. So that then they are beyond the
reproach. Yeah, that's the same, sort of the same thing as being a novice.
So there has to be a testing, and the congregation has to feel like they are moved beyond that, whatever it was, if there was something in the background.
Okay.
We need to be tested about it. And we all, like I said, we all have those things in our past.
Tad, did you have something?
I was just going to mention, this isn't really that important, but being blameless, we tend to think of it in terms of like spiritual things or like moral conduct, but I definitely think it's more than that. It means above reproach in every way. Like one thing I mentioned in my sermon on Sunday was that, you know, part of the reason we're supposed to follow all the laws of the government is so that no one has anything bad to say about us. And I think it's kind of the same thing, that an elder is the kind of person, they follow the rules, there's just nothing bad that you can say about them.
Yeah. When I was putting this, my little section together, I thought, how do I want to organize this? And I decided that I would organize it by asking the same three questions. I would ask, what does it mean to be this qualification? Why must an elder have that qualification? And then the third question I thought I would always ask is, how do we know that an elder is this qualification? Okay, so how do we know that an elder is blameless? And I didn't put anything underneath that little question. And the reason why is that as we get to the details, as we start talking about the rest of these qualifications, that helps us answer this big question. How do you know that the elder is blameless? Well, because they're not riotous, they're not violent, they're not given to alcohol, they're not greedy, and all of these other qualifications. That answers the overarching question, how do we know that they're blameless? Okay, we're going to spend more time around these next two, even though I think blameless is important. I think as we get to some of these other, we'll again see that they also talk about being blameless. All right, in 1 Timothy 3, in verse 2, it says, a bishop then must be blameless, the husband of one wife, temperate, sober-minded, of good behavior, hospitable, able to teach. So here we see the next of the qualifications that I've been asked to talk on, and that is of good behavior. It's a good thing that 2- and 4-year-olds don't get to be elders, because it's not always a good behavior. I'm not sure that that's exactly, I mean, when I think of, you know, be on your best behavior, I think of what we say to children, but it's not exactly the same thing. What does it mean to be of good behavior? Well, the Greek word here literally translates to something like respectable or honorable. That might be how we literally translate it. I'm not sure that it totally gives us the picture. This particular word here in 1 Timothy 3 is only used one other time in the New Testament. And it's in 1 Timothy chapter 2 and verse 9. So if someone would turn there and read it, and then tell me what you think the Greek word, or the translated Greek word that means the same thing as of good behavior. 1 Timothy 2 and 9.
in like manner also that women adorn themselves in modest apparel, with propriety and moderation, not afraid of hair or gold or pearls or costly clothing.
Okay, so somewhere in here is a word that is the same. That's right, it's modest. And you think, well, it doesn't really make sense, but it does. Sometimes this word is translated as modest or orderly. So this idea of being of good behavior, it means respectable, honorable, but it's sometimes translated as modest, or could be translated orderly. The verb form of this Greek word is used in Matthew chapter 25, verse 7. Again, sort of an obscure use of the word. Here this is the parable of the 10 virgins, and in chapter 25, verse 7, it says, "Then all those virgins arose and trimmed their lamps." Well, the word "trimmed" there is the equivalent verb form of good behavior. It means to put in order. To trim one's lamp is to get it ready, to put it in order, or to adorn. That may be another way to describe it. And so we kind of get this big picture of what this word means. What is being said being of good behavior? It's not the same thing as what we say to our kids, be on your best behavior, but in some ways it is. It's about being respectable, honorable, doing things orderly, being modest, adorning yourself in an appropriate way, carry the connotation of not being rude, but being polite, orderly, respectful. That's sort of kind of a lot of words that describe what is being said here.
And it kind of gives the idea of being in control of
yourself.
Yes. Self-control.
Yeah. And actually,
even though we have that word, I think, as a separate one, but...
Well, yeah, look at the words the qualifications. Others will talk about this, but look at the two qualifications prior to of good behavior. They're very similar. Temperate and sober-minded. And that carries that idea of being in control. And then you go down a couple, not giving the wine, not violent. Those are sort of related things. So why must an elder be of good behavior? Okay, he's an example. An example to who?
To the assembly.
All right, to other Christians, but who else?
To the world,
yeah. And you know, we'll see this. A lot of are Christians told to be blameless? Yeah, Christians are told to be blameless. Are Christians told to be of good behavior? Yeah. All of these qualifications, with the exception of a few, we could look to and say, these are things that all Christians should strive to do. Now, the difference here is that it's not an option for elders. If you want to be an elder, then these are musts. These aren't optional.
Well, the other reason is what you said before, is because discipline is part of being good behavior, because, you know, then you've got... Try to go to someone and say, hey, you know, you really shouldn't have done that. Well, what's the first words out of their mouth if you're not a good behavior? You did it.
Yeah.
Or you do this, and it's just as bad. So it's the example, like Matt said.
Yeah, that's right. It helps set a good example. You know, the elders are shepherds. It gives you this connotation that they are leading the flock, leading the sheep. And we're supposed to follow their example. And so if elders are immodest or impolite, they aren't orderly, you know, what kind of congregation are we going to have? Remember, Jesus prayed for unity amongst the members of the church. And I think that when we look at the opposite of good behavior, we sort of have this free-for-all of behavior. And is there any unity in that? There isn't. So I think certainly the idea of helping the members become better, being an example to them, this idea of keeping unity amongst the congregation, kind of keeping the congregation cohesive, when you're of good behavior, you're putting others in front of your own need. Now, some of that is sort of subjective, but you're also being an example to those who are outside, so you help to convert people. So it gets this idea of... why an elder must be of good behavior. Other thoughts on that?
First Peter, fourth chapter, it's saying if you're going to be reproached, blessed are you for the Spirit
the glory and of God rest upon you. On their part he is blasphemed, and on your part he is glorified. But let none of you suffer as a murderer, a thief, an evildoer, or a busybody in other people's matters. And if anyone suffers as a Christian, let him not be ashamed, but let him glorify God in this matter. And the point is that if you're not a good behavior, you are going to be condemned, and rightfully so.
All right, good. So how do we know that an elder has good behavior?
Well, this kind of goes along with comments. There's degrees in most of these. It's like some of them are not. There's no degree, like you said before, husband and wife. You're either you are or you're not. Yeah. But there's degrees in this, and it really comes down to the heart of that person. Are they really? How well do you know their part? And if they have had things in the past, they will really work to prove themselves that they've made it over that. That that's not a stumbling block for them now. And so it's kind of subjective in a way. You know?
Yeah. And most of the qualifications are subjective.
Yeah. And it comes down to whether the whole congregation needs to pretty well agree that, yes, we think they qualify in this area.
Have you ever, I'm 100% positive I'm not the only person who's ever done this. And you read the gospel message, or you visit other congregations, and you discover that someone was appointed as an elder, you think, why? It wouldn't work in our congregation. Well, that's sort of the point, isn't it? That elders are appointed to lead the flock that is there. And they may be perfectly capable and perfectly qualified to lead the congregation. But put in a different situation, they might not be the appropriate person. Now, part of that is you're going to know the person. You're going to know whether or not good behavior is or good testimony, all these qualifications that may not be exactly clean or just very defined. And part of it is that it could be one of those things that, it just doesn't fit for that congregation. I want to be careful with that, because I think we can say that God has a plan for who can be elders and who shouldn't be elders. But I think there is some latitude.
That's why it's so important that when you pick an elder or a deacon, that they need to be a part of your congregation for a length of time so that you really know them. And we know of situations where maybe somebody came from another place and supposedly they had a good reputation there, and they come in, and then you say, oh, well, they were good there, let's just check them out, they'll fit right in. And you find out, we didn't really know that person. We needed to know that person. So, it's not like somebody can have just, from some other place that shows up and they're there just for a little while, and you really need to be around and know them.
Yeah. So I'm thinking of two things here. One is, you look at the work that Paul and those that traveled with him did. They went and preached, and then they came back, and it appears as though when they came back is when they appointed the elders. It wasn't right then when the congregation was established. Part of it was, they needed to not be novices. But on the flip side of that, think about the appointment of deacons. It appears as though the appointment of deacons happened relatively quickly. I'm not sure how we reconcile. I think you're right. I think you got to know. The point is, you know who this person is. I guess we could maybe think that the Holy Spirit absolutely helped in Acts 6.
That's the first thing that come to my mind is that in getting the church started, the Holy Spirit was very instrumental in knowing things that we wouldn't. In other words, as a human being, we can only judge by what we see. So if you haven't been around a person long enough to see them, in other words, they have to be around long enough to prove themselves.
So imagine the apostles had
we know they had special power on this Sunday.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, and they could. But they left it up to the congregation to choose. And, of course, I think they could have, if they saw something wrong, they could have said something, they would have said something. They wouldn't let somebody in the point of it.
Yeah. Well, and the Spirit guided the process, and I think we need to be confident that the Spirit works in a similar way today.
Well, we need to remember this. These are, like you said, these are guidelines. These are qualifications that every Christian should have. But Christians are in all different phases of maturation, and elders are supposed to be at the peak of Christian maturation, of maturity.
Right.
You know, but it doesn't mean they're perfect, because there wouldn't be any of us, are there, that would be, we wouldn't qualify, you know, to require perfection.
All right, let's look at our last one. We have maybe 5 or so minutes of good testimony, and specifically here, 1 Timothy 3:7 says that they have a good testimony of those outside of the church. I think this really talks about our reputation. God is concerned about our reputation to other Christians and to other people. Remember what Proverbs 22:1 says: a good name is what?
Rather be chosen.
That's the idea. Rather than great riches and loving favor, rather than silver and gold. That's the idea, that it's better to have a good name than have a whole bunch of money. Right? That's the idea. And we see another passage very similar in Ecclesiastes 7:1. A good name is better than precious ointment, and the day of death than the day of one's birth. So this idea that our reputation is important, should be important to us. We couldn't buy a reputation. You know, that's why it says it's more precious than great riches. But why would God command a qualification which basically says you can't be an elder unless non-Christians speak well of you? Such a strange thing, right? We would really expect the opposite, wouldn't we? We might expect something like, well, if non-Christians don't speak well of you, that's a good thing, because, you know, you're rebuking them of their sins. And if they speak well of you, well, maybe you're not doing your duty as a Christian. Maybe you're compromising God's word in your life. Why is it that God would make this qualification that says you've got to have a good reputation of non-Christians? Why would he do that?
Honesty, trustworthiness.
Yeah. It's this idea of being above reproach again, isn't it? That we, as Christians, we all ought to have a good testimony amongst each other. But this talks about how good of an individual that is, that even people outside of the Lord's body recognize that this person is above reproach. They have a good testimony. An elder has to live in such a way that even unbelievers give a good testimony of him. They should be forced, almost. It seems like they're forced to say, he's wise, he's upright, we have really nothing to say to him. He behaves honorably, he's innocent amongst his life. Those ideas. Cal?
Yeah, you kind of touched on what I was going to say right there. I think in some ways there might be a moral level and a spiritual level. You may be able to rebuke a sinner, but yet maintain your you may rebuke them in a spiritual sense, but maintain your moral integrity, your moral testimony with them in the way that you do. They may say, well, you can tell he's a Christian because he says things that are Christ-like, or he tells me when I've done something wrong, but yet you can tell he's always an honest person.
You know, people can hate the fact that you're a Christian and still have a good testimony in you. They can still have no charge against you. And this isn't the only time that Christians having a good reputation in the world is discussed. Colossians 4:5, we're told, walk in wisdom toward those who are outside, redeeming the time. In 1 Thessalonians 4, verse 12, it says that you may walk properly towards those who are outside, that you may lack nothing.
So let's ask this last question. Why must an elder have a good testimony? Well, this keeps the elder from falling into reproach. You know, if they have a bad reputation outside of the church, eventually that bad reputation is going to make its way into the membership. It's going to make the elder's job that much more difficult because the sheep, the congregation will eventually stop trusting him. I think it also is very specific here. They're told to have a good reputation for it. What's it say there in 1 Timothy? Why is it that they're going to have a good reputation for those who are outside?
Not falling into the disgrace of the devil.
Yeah, not to fall into the snare of the devil. Now, this could be speaking about pride. I don't think so, because the verse just prior to it talks about them not being a novice and being lifted up in pride. I think this is something different. I think this is speaking just generically of sin. Consider what we're told in 2 Timothy chapter 2, verse 24 through 26. I think it's talking about evangelists. But here it says, "And a servant of the Lord must not quarrel, but be gentle to all, able to teach, patient, in humility, correcting those who are in opposition. And God perhaps will grant them repentance, so that they may know the truth, that they may come to their senses, and escape the snare of the devil, having been taken captive by him to do his will." Notice here in 2 Timothy, Paul, writing to the same individual, equates the snare of the devil to a life of sin. So it appears as though you're supposed to have a good reputation to those who are outside as an elder to avoid the snare of sin. Now, how do you know that an elder has a good testimony amongst those who are outside? Well, this qualification is speaking of the character. Is he honest in his dealing with all people? Is he known for being an upstanding man who can be trusted? Is he a troublemaker? That would certainly disqualify him. Is he a hypocrite? And this is going to be maybe one that's the most difficult for us, because we spend most of our time with people who are outside in the world, and it's easy for us to fall into a snare. I want to finish by going to a place that is unrelated to elders. The three qualifications that we talked about were blameless, having a good behavior, and good reputation. And I want you to think about Daniel. Daniel was not an elder, obviously, but Daniel was a leader in a physical way, but also a leader in a spiritual way. In Daniel, the 6th chapter, this is later on in Daniel's life, chapter 6, verse 3, "This Daniel distinguished himself above the governors and satraps because an excellent spirit was in him, and the king gave thought to setting him over the whole realm." Now think about this. Was the king of the Medes and the Persians, was he a righteous guy? By no means, no. He was a wicked man. And yet, he had to recognize, here's Daniel, one of the 120 that was selected, and Daniel raised himself up above the crowd. God raised Daniel up, so that even an unbeliever was forced to speak highly of Daniel and entrusted him great responsibilities. Now look at verse 4. What was the result of that? "So that the governors and satraps sought to find some charge against Daniel concerning the kingdom, but they could find no charge or fault, because he was faithful, nor was there any error or fault found in him." Think about that. That is a good example of what an elder needs to be. Even though his peers didn't like that he had gotten elevated, when they looked for fault, they couldn't find any real fault. What fault did they find? Prayer. And generically, that Daniel was loyal to God. So, if we're going to find fault in our elders, or people outside of the world are, let's hope that they find the fault that the governor found in Daniel, that he was at fault for his devotion to God. Any other comments before we close?
I'm just thinking that the snare of the devil, the elder is really susceptible to that. The devil would love to snare the leaders of the congregation, foremost, first and foremost. And so that's why.
I think it is.
With Daniel, I mean, when it was mentioned, oh, Daniel may be a leader, a ruler. Look at him, how they flocked around him, trying to trap him in any way they could.
I think, what do you say? If you cut off a snake's head, its eyes, or something like that. I don't know what the phrase is. If Satan can pick off an elder, Think of the damage that we do. Eric, you got a closing number? That's sand and closing number.